On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
I do want to go forward today and tell you that as of today, based on the information and the facts as we know them, we are now investigating these horrific acts as an act of terrorism. We have uncovered evidence that has led us to learn of extensive planning. Obviously, we've uncovered evidence of explosive, multiple armaments, you know that. You know the ammunition that was out there, the high-powered weapons, the explosive devices. We are continuing to go down the path to ensure that we find all of the evidence that pertains to this matter.
That's David Bowditch, Assistant Director in charge of the FBI in Los Angeles, announcing a few moments ago that the attacks in San Bernardino were indeed an act of terror. The attacks killed 14 people and wounded 21 on Wednesday at the Inland Regional Center. Joining us now to talk about how this changes the conversation about this mass shooting is Adam Langford, criminal justice professor at the University of Alabama and author of the book, The Myth of Martyrdom. Welcome to the program.
Hi, nice to speak with you.
Well, great to have you. What does it mean, do you think, that the FBI has taken the lead in this investigation and is now calling this incident an act of terrorism?
Well, the fact that the FBI is taking the lead, you know, is not necessarily surprising. They could still do that if this was a classic active shooter incident or mass shooting incident. But the fact that they've called it an act of terrorism, I think, is really just kind of signaling to the public where they are with this investigation and what they believe the motive could be. What I would emphasize is there's a big difference between the possibility that these individuals were inspired by ISIS and self-radicalized, or the alternative possibility that, you know, ISIS somehow communicated with them or guided their actions. The latter is certainly much more frightening, and I'm sure that's what the FBI will be looking into. Is there any evidence that people are still alive and out there who made this attack possible? Or are the two people who are primarily responsible for this dead, and we just have to deal with a broader terrorist threat in the same kind of geopolitical ways that we would otherwise?
Well, let's talk about that first possibility that you mentioned, that they were inspired possibly by ISIS or al-Qaeda or other terrorist groups and were self-radicalized. Now, you study these mass shootings and you study these perpetrators. How unusual is that?
Well, when it comes to these types of offenders, it's actually not that unusual. So one of the misnomers, the misconceptions when it comes to this idea of it being terrorism, is that it's either a matter of a radical ideology on the one hand or mental illness and personal problems on the other hand, and it's usually a blend of both. In other words, we shouldn't be surprised when people who are struggling with personal problems latch on to a radical ideology. So in cases like Columbine, in a variety of other cases that were mass shootings, people latched on to a radical ideology. And there also have been cases where they've been inspired by Islamic extremism, but carried out mass shootings. So we've seen mass shootings in this country at military bases, at the Empire State Building in 1997, in 1993 at the CIA headquarters. So those seem to be functionally similar to this in terms of having that ideological motive.
Well, how many are prompted by an ideological motive versus, you know, an act of passion or a workplace grudge against a coworker or an act of domestic violence that's taken public?
Well, that's a good question. And the hardest thing in the world to do is to read these people's minds and know what their motives are. So when do we find out if they were inspired by an ideology? Normally just if we can find some sort of document that they left behind or trace in terms of their internet behavior. So in some cases, we don't know. I would say it's pretty common, and some of the ideologies are really, you know, pretty wacky, you know, various strains of neo-Nazism. I've seen people who are in favor of eugenics. Certainly the attacker who struck the Charleston church this summer had a racist ideology. So I think those things are relatively common, but sometimes they, as we saw this week, can also kind of fit with a workplace grudge or something like that.
Right, if that indeed was part of the motive, we don't know yet. What is also unusual is that a woman was involved and that there was a two-person team.
Well, that's right. And we have seen two people attacked before. Columbine is the probably example that people would be most familiar with. But the idea that it was a man and a woman attacking together, that's unprecedented. Based on my study of more than 40 years of these attacks around the world. I have seen cases where a husband and a wife or a man and a woman in a romantic relationship did commit suicide attacks in the Middle East. So there is some precedent for that, but this particular type of thing in this country or anywhere else where it's a mass shooting with a man and a woman seems to be the first of its kind.
So you've spent 40 years studying, or you've studied 40 years of these attacks, and it seems that there are more now. Is that true? Does that bear out your,
is that borne out in your
research?
Yeah, so, you know, the best source on that is probably the FBI active shooter report, which came out a year ago that found a clear rise in incidents from 2000 to 2013, which is when the data is very reliable. But when we look back at the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, there were even fewer of these attacks. So that evidence is pretty clear. And I guess the frightening thing is this idea of copycats. And you could have copycats who are committing kind of classic grudge-based mass shootings, but you could also have copycats with these attacks that are really ideologically driven as well.
And is that one of the hypotheses behind the increase?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it's kind of, if you think of the snowball rolling downhill, you know, every additional attacker is a model who could potentially inspire future attackers. So, you know, that's one of the frightening things here. And based on the documents, you know, the suicide notes, manifestos, letters, and internet posts these individuals often leave behind, we know that they pay attention to previous attackers, try to learn from them, and sometimes try to top them, exceed them in terms of the amount of damage they do and the attention they receive.
And so was Columbine the first one of these that kind of started the snowball in terms of the increase?
No, it wasn't the first, but it was one of the most notable. And Columbine has been referenced by a number of attackers since then, both in the United States and around the world.
Adam Langford, criminal justice professor at the University of Alabama and author of the book, The Myth of Martyrdom. Thanks for joining us.
Sure, thank you.
The attackers in San Bernardino had more than 6,000 rounds of ammunition in their house and in their car. Here's San Bernardino Police Chief Jared Burguan yesterday at a press conference.
The suspects are believed to have fired about 76 rifle rounds at the officers at the termination of the pursuit. However, on them, on their person, on their body, and in the vehicle, they had over 1,400 .223 caliber rounds that were available to them. And they had over 209 millimeter rounds on their persons as well. The house in Redlands that became part of the focus of this investigation yesterday, there were another 2,000 9 millimeter rounds, over 2,500 223 rounds that were found at that house, and there were additional several hundred 22 long rifle rounds that were found there.
Well, back in October, Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom released a proposed ballot initiative to strengthen gun laws in California, including new restrictions on the sale of ammunition. And joining us now to talk about that and whether or not it will be or could be effective is Eugene Volokh, professor at UCLA School of Law. Welcome back to Press Play.
Always good to be on.
Well, great to have you. So are ammunition sales currently tracked in the United States and here in California?
So federal law doesn't regulate ammunition sales much at all. California law regulates handgun ammunition sales. There's currently a litigation pending over the constitutionality of that. The question is whether the law is unconstitutionally vague. There are attempts to regulate ammunition sales so that you can kind of track down who it is who bought some particular batch of ammunition. The problem is, you know, there are 300 million guns in the country, and that probably means we don't have a census, but there are probably about 100 billion rounds of ammunition. That's billion with a B. In California alone, you know, you don't know how many, but certainly several billion rounds. And that's in part because when people do target shooting, perfectly normal target shooting, you don't just buy a dozen rounds. You're probably going to use maybe a couple of hundred rounds in a target shooting session. People often buy in bulk. You can buy bulk units of 1,000 or something like that. It's cheaper that way, as with so much buying in bulk. So any attempt to crack down in any serious way on retail sales of ammunition, it will affect target shooters. It won't really affect criminals or would-be mass shooters because there's just so much out there. They could easily buy stuff on black market, is making it sound too glamorous in a sense. It'll just be people around. You know, you go up to somebody saying, you know, you have 100 rounds of ammo in your closet. You'd sell me for a couple hundred bucks? Sure.
Hmm. You could get it on the internet too, right?
Pardon?
You could get it on the internet as well, right?
Well, that's right. Now, in principle, if a state bans sales, there may be ways of trying to stop the mail order shippers from shipping into the state. But again, it's just hard to imagine that having much of an effect given the amount of ammo out there. The other thing is ammunition turns out not to be hard to make. And there are people who do it as a hobby. It's called reloading. And what they do is they take what you need is the brass, the thing in which the bullet sits. You need the lead to make the bullet. You need primer and gunpowder. All of that is easily available. To the extent you want to track ammunition, you would probably be tracking the brass. Maybe you could micro-stamp it somehow or something like that. Trouble is, if you go to a shooting range, you'll see all of this brass laying on the floor. People are supposed to clean up after themselves, but they're not as neat as one might like. So all you need to do if you want to get some anonymous brass is you just go to a shooting range and pick up something that was ejected from a neighbor's gun. This is really something that's very hard to imagine how any kind of regulation like this is going to stop. Certainly stop the determined killers, the people who are not kind of on the fence. Should I get a gun? Should I not? Should I get ammo or should I not? These are people who have decided to make a mass killing the defining act of their lives. In fact, probably the final act of their lives. Hard to see how they would be much stymied by requirements that they put down a thumbprint in order to buy ammunition,
right?
Especially since in this case, at least the husband was an American citizen without a criminal record. No background check would have stopped him.
Right, right. Well, what about in other cases, though, things that are not mass shootings but still gun violence? What about background checks for ammunition purchases and the lieutenant governor's proposal, which would require a point-of-sale background check?
So the problem is, whom is the background check going to catch? Let's say the theory is you're trying to catch felons. Well, the felon already has committed a crime by possessing the gun. Either he got the gun illegally or he got it legally way back when, but now he's possessing it illegally because he now has a felony conviction. So it's not clear. So he managed to somehow get the gun illegally, but he can't get the ammo illegally, even though ammo is cheaper and more portable and easier to get. Hard to imagine how somebody who really wants to commit a crime with a gun and who somehow gets his hands on the gun is going to be stymied by the supposed difficulty of getting your hands on ammunition.
All right, let's talk about the other part of his ballot proposal, and that would be to eliminate the stockpile of large-capacity magazines with 11 rounds or more. What do you think about that? That would essentially force people or require people to give up their guns, their high-capacity guns.
Well, one thing just to keep in mind about any proposal, whether it's guns, drugs, anything else, is it's impossible to have a proposal to eliminate things. You could have a proposal to ban it, as we can tell from the war on drugs, for example, banning is very different from eliminating. So the proposal would be to prohibit people from lawfully possessing magazines that are larger than 10 rounds. And so people would still, there would still be a black market of them and people who just don't turn theirs in and such. But I guess the theory is that while a mass shooter is going to get a gun, and they, maybe he's going to choose a more convenient magazine. And if it's a little bit harder to get, say, a 20-round or a 14-round magazine, he's going to get the 10-round magazine. Of course, you would probably get multiple magazines, and in fact, many of the mass shooters come with multiple magazines. But again, the theory is maybe when he is changing magazines, what will happen is somebody could tackle him, or he'll drop the magazine or something like that. So, you know, it's possible that in a very, very few instances, a small fraction of all mass shootings, this will indeed give somebody the opportunity to stop the guy while he is switching magazines. As you may know, switching magazines is a very quick process, but there is some interruption in the shooting. It is also possible that in some equally rare situations, it'll stop somebody from lawfully defending themselves effectively. So somebody has only a 10-round magazine, he's being attacked in his home by, let's say, four home invaders, and as a result, he runs out of bullets and they kill him. So it's one of those things where the law is, it's very unlikely it'll have much effect because most shootings don't involve anywhere near 10 rounds, and those that do, people can easily get multiple magazines, but it could have some positive effect, could have some negative effect. It's one of the many, many proposals out there that if it has any effect at all, will have a tiny effect on the margins, maybe worth experimenting with. I wouldn't expect great things from it.
All right. Eugene Volokh, law professor at UCLA. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. All the best.
Well, we want to hear from you. What do you think? Should ammunition sales be regulated? What do you think of the lieutenant governor's proposals? Leave us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can comment on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up on the program, writer Rachel Kushner is here to talk about her new short story about a homeless man and the research she did in California's prisons. That's next on Press Play.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. A short story in this week's New Yorker magazine is fiction, but it really reads like a slice of real life in Los Angeles. It follows a homeless man who gets released from jail and then ends up arrested again the very same day. Rachel Kushner wrote that story. She's a writer based here in LA, and she's here now. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, so the story begins with your character getting released back on the streets. And so I was wondering if you could read that from your story, kind of near the beginning, where he's released and he's trying to figure out where to go.
Sure. He was barred from Skid Row, where he knew how to live. He was on Sepulveda Boulevard, but it might as well have been Jupiter. He bought a can of soda from a street vendor and a knife off another homeless guy outside a liquor store. He figured he needed something for protection since he would be back on the streets. And he was thirsty, which was why he bought the soda from one of the Mexicans with a cooler on wheels, a dirty cooler full of dirty ice and dripping cold cans of overpriced soda. But when it's your last few dollars, you're not on a budget. It makes no difference how much the soda costs. You can't make the money last. The girl. That was all they wanted to know about after it was all over and they'd picked him up again. The girl. The girl.
So he can't be on Skid Row. He's been barred from Skid Row. Was the homeless situation in Los Angeles, you don't have to go far to see evidence of it. Did that inform you at all when you were writing the story?
It wasn't so much thinking about homelessness qua homelessness, but more about the experiences of people who move in and out of jail and prison. These are institutions that really put people in a position where they do not have many resources on the outside. So most people getting out of Men's Central Jail, Twin Towers, downtown, from what I understand, most do not have a place to go. And I think that people are released quite often in the middle of the night. And Men's Central Jail is right next to Skid Row. It seemed like a typical scenario.
Yeah. And so the girl, he ends up killing a girl. It seems almost preordained in a sense. I'm wondering if that's sort of what you're talking about, this kind of inescapability of the criminal life.
I spend a lot of time talking to people who are currently serving life sentences in prison. And so I think that it's been important for me as a writer and a person to try to do something that's almost impossible, which is to see things from their point of view. And a lot of times their upbringing does seem to make the later act that they commit that ends up putting them into a situation where they're serving a life sentence, those acts do seem somewhat inevitable only because of the profound levels of violence and trauma that every one of these people have experienced in their earlier lives. So I think that someone like that was on my mind, and I just began to see things from his point of view.
And yet he doesn't have a name, this guy.
His name is not important to him in the segment of his life that is shared in the story. And I don't think his name is important to the institutional structures that illuminate him as a factor in the city, in jail, and in prison, and to police. Because once you're in that system, you are filed as a number, and you become your number, and it is far more important than your name, which really for a lot of people in prison becomes a kind of secret and one of the only secrets that they can harbor. They don't want people to know their name.
Really?
Yeah.
Why? Because it's just their last thing that they can have to themselves?
Perhaps, yeah.
So the title of your story is 57, a number. And this, we find out, is his IQ.
His score, yeah.
Yeah. But then there's some confusion. Initially, the system thinks he might be a genius because it says 157. What did you want to illustrate there?
I think that there's sometimes a sense of great distance between children and those assessing them or moving them through a system, like maybe educators. And with all due respect, of course, for teachers in the public education system, with this particular character, I was thinking about his childhood and how the question of his aptitude, his intelligence, would not necessarily be answered by a test that he was given. I was interviewed by Deborah Treisman at The New Yorker. It's a standard thing they do with each week's story. And she asked me about IQ scores. And I knew what I thought about them only when I answered her question, which was that I don't think intelligence can be reduced to a number. He's given quite a low intelligence quotient score. It could be that he's not able to listen carefully and answer questions. So I think he's somebody who cannot read the cultural markers that the test is also testing.
What struck me, too, about your character was just how little agency he has over his life. You know, I found that really sad. Like, I found myself feeling really sorry for him, even though he didn't just kill this girl. He killed other people later. He's a murderer many times over.
I was thinking about his childhood, and children are structurally passive because they have to adapt to the environment into which they are put. So for me, it's not a question of a character trait vis-a-vis active or passive, but what you're handed. Hmm. And maybe I was thinking of the people who I know who have been given sentences like life without the possibility of parole. I don't know anyone with an LWOP sentence who wasn't raised in foster care. Perhaps that's a coincidence, but perhaps it isn't a coincidence that a lot of these people were not raised by loving parents, or perhaps they were born into situations where there was a lot of poverty and abuse. So I don't see him as so much passive, but somebody who had a very rough deal from the beginning.
Well, thanks so much for speaking with us about it.
Thank you for your interest, Madeline.
That's Rachel Kushner. Her story, 57, is in this week's New Yorker magazine. Coming up, we'll have your movie reviews, Macbeth, She-Rock, Youth.
This is sort of like an artful kind of Fellini-esque version of Grumpy Old Men.
Our Friday's film segment after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It is a total grab bag at the movies this weekend. And here to run down the new releases are Christy Lemire, film critic and co-host of What the Flick on YouTube. Welcome back.
Hi, thank you so much.
And Tim Gerson, senior U.S. critic for Screen International and vice president of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, let's kick it off today with the film adaptation of Macbeth, starring Michael Fassbender and Marion Cotillard.
I feel now the future. Hail, King the Chelpy.
My dearest love, Duncan comes here tonight.
Look like the innocent flower, but be the serpent under it.
All hail Macbeth that shall be king hereafter.
Wow, Christy, sounds like a lot of toil and trouble there.
Yeah, and sound and fury. It is enormous, and it's beautiful, and it's violent, and it's visceral. There's this giant climax, this red-soaked climax that suggests Macbeth on Mars. It's just beautiful and strange. But intriguingly, in contrast, like the really important monologues and the lines that we all know are delivered in a whisper, out damn spot. It's like that. It's like, it's a
really?
Weird, yeah. But
I would think that she should be bellowing that.
She's not. She is like dreamy, sleepwalky in the misty morning light.
Tim?
Yeah, the way Christy describes it is dead on. I mean, it's very much like Shakespeare on steroids sort of thing. It has like this like apocalyptic sort of feel to it. And it's gorgeously shot. And the battle sequence and the fight sequences are amazing. And, you know, and I love Michael Fassbender. I love Marion Cotillard. I wish I liked this movie better, to be honest. I think it is gorgeous on a big screen. If people are curious, they should definitely see on the biggest screen that they can, because it has like this like epic canvas feel to it. But I feel like the play itself doesn't come through very strongly in the piece. Mm. And while I think Fassbender is sort of a perfect Macbeth in certain ways, Cotillard to me is a little too, almost too reserved and a little too remote in certain ways to kind of capture the real essence of, I think, what makes Lady Macbeth such a great character in the play as well. There's a lot, I think, that's enjoyable about the film, but overall, I did find it a little underwhelming.
It's a little truncated. Like, if you didn't read Macbeth in high school or see any of the previous incarnations of Macbeth, this is not going to go out of its way to explain why certain characters matter, why certain details matter. It feels, it's under 2 hours long, you know, but it's beautiful, though. You know,
this isn't a Shakespeare play that gets made very often in Hollywood.
There was a Polanski version in 1971. Uh-huh. Orson Welles did it in 1946. There's a Kurosawa version, right?
Oh.
Well, Thrones of Blood. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, but again, you know, murder and mayhem are like Michael Fassbender's bread and butter. So this is a pretty conflicted, tormented man or his thing. So,
well, we'll get people who aren't into Shakespeare to see it.
I don't think so. I mean, I think especially for high school kids who want to skip reading the play and see this movie instead, don't do it. It's a bad idea. Stick with it. I think the Polanski one actually works better as far as that goes. It's funny because the filmmaker, Justin Kurzel, is actually doing next Assassin's Creed. He's doing that video game remake with Marion Cotillard. and Michael Fassbender.
Really?
Same cast.
So this is like a prequel to that?
In some ways, it feels like a run-through of like, okay, I can do violence and mayhem and whispery dialogue and stuff like that. I mean, it's, I think if you're curious, check it out, but I don't think it's going to convert people, put it that way.
Okay, let's move on to another literary deep cut, Chirac, based on an Aristophanes play called Lysistrata, and it's made by Spike Lee.
Dude, this is about life and death, about a community that's a wreck. And you want to sit here and talk about how women behave? Fool, we trying to free these slaves. Slaves to the madness, slaves to this violence. And what, you just want us to silence? We gonna make sure these fools put down these guns and stop thinking that this craziness is fun.
Tim, is this entire movie in verse?
It is entirely in verse. Yes, it is. And that was, Spike Lee has been developing this project for about 4 or 6 years, something like that. Mm-hmm. And it's, that was always part of it. There was going to be this rhymed verse as part of the movie. Essentially, the story is that it's set in modern day Chicago. Two African-American gangs are killing each other. And so the girlfriends and wives decide to put on a sex strike. They will not have sex with their men until they put down their guns and stop the violence. And so for people who, like me, love Spike Lee in general, but also like movies like Bamboozled, his kind of like loud satires, this one's kind of in that vein. I don't think it's as good as something like Bamboozled. I there's the ambition of it and the intention behind it, I think, is really terrific. To me, it's a little too all over the map. It's both a satire. It's also like a kind of a condemnation of violence in the way like the city of Chicago kind of ignores its lowest, most poor citizens. I wish I liked it more.
It's his most vital and passionate film since Do the Right Thing. I mean, you can feel his anger. You can feel his outrage in every single minute of this film. So I think it's really important in that regard. It is bringing a light to a story that has been going on for so long and mm-hmm. no one wants to talk about it. Yes, the verse thing is potentially off-putting. It's trying to do a lot of things at once. It's got a lot of pieces of previous films. There's a scene straight out of School Days. There's a giant musical number straight out of School Days. There's a scene with women sitting on the couch talking very frankly about sex, which reminded me of Jungle Fever. So it's pieces of his other films, but it's also incredibly of this moment. It's very passionate, but yeah, kind of a mess. And yeah, I would say see it.
Huh. And, you know, just looking at the preview, I liked Samuel Jackson playing the chorus, a one-man chorus.
Like he did in Do the Right Thing.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's great. Mm-hmm.
And Tiana Paris, who stars in it as Lysistrata, is just formidable. She was in Dear White People, which
right.
was great.
Oh, yeah.
She's just got this enormous presence to her. Yeah, great cast. John Cusack's very good in it as this priest, who is sort of the voice of reason.
So yeah. It sounds like you're liking it a little better than Tim.
I am, yeah. It's strange, but worth seeing.
All right, now a meditation on aging. It's called Youth, and it stars Michael Caine, Harvey Keitel, and Rachel Weisz.
Daddy, you will not be bored because I have arranged the full service for you. You're going to have a massage, a sauna, checkups with the doctor every single day to help you get back in shape.
At my age, getting in shape is merely a waste of time.
Oh, God, you guys have got a strange friendship.
No, it's just a good friendship. And in a good friendship, you only tell each other the good things.
Did you take a piss today?
4 drops.
You? Same. More or less.
More or less?
Less.
Well, this really sounds like the opposite of Chirac. I mean, could there be more dissimilar movies?
Yes, there's something out there for everybody this weekend at the movies. This is sort of like an artful kind of Fellini-esque version of Grumpy Old Men. So if you're looking for that, so Michael Caine is this like longtime maestro and Harvey Keitel is this veteran filmmaker and they're both about 80 years old and they've reached this point in their careers where they're both blocked. They don't want to give up entirely. They're not ready to retire, but they're just not firing on all cylinders like they once were. So they go on this long vacation together to this incredible resort in the Swiss Alps. And this bizarre menagerie of people is there. It's totally Fellini-esque. And at one point, all the women who've ever starred in any of Keitel's films, his muses, all stand there on a hillside beckoning to him. And at one point, Jane Fonda comes to him, who is his longtime muse. And she has this one scene, like 8 minutes, and it's just this killer scene. She just rips in him. It's beautiful and strange, kind of like everything else this week.
It sounds a little like they're trying to be Fellini.
A little bit.
It's the same filmmaker, Paolo Sorrentino, who did The Great Beauty from a couple years ago that won the Best Foreign Language Film Oscar, and that movie also felt very Fellini-esque. This is very much in his wheelhouse. That's what he does. And, you know, I don't know if we need any more movies about art and aging and urinating.
And old men trying to get their mojo back.
But I will say, though, this movie is so beautiful, I kind of didn't care. Because I think that this is the type of movie where the visuals and the sweep of it make up for a lot of conversations about we're aging, what does that mean? Art, what does it mean? Along with what Christy said, Paul Dano is also really great as this actor's actor who is studying for this role that's very complex for him. And I want to reveal who it turns out that he's playing, but I think that's one of the best jokes in the movie. Rachel Weisz as Michael Caine's daughter is really good in it. Again, definitely a big screen movie because you kind of get swept up in it.
All right, next up, also for perhaps the older set, Maggie Smith starring as a woman living in her van in a movie. It's called The Lady in the Van. In this clip, the lady is invited to park her van in a neighbor's driveway.
It might not be convenient.
No, I've thought it over. Believe me, Miss Shepherd, it's all right. Just till you sort yourself out.
But not convenient for you. Convenient for me. You're not doing me a favor, you know. I have got other fish to fry. A man on the pavement told me if I went south of the river, I'd be welcomed with open arms.
I was about to do her a good turn, but as ever, it was not without thoughts of strangulation.
Christy, what's happened to Lady Grantham?
Right, this is what happens to the dowager when she goes away.
Yeah.
So it's based on a true story. There was this cantankerous old woman who had a van and was going to just park her van very temporarily in the driveway belonging to playwright Alan Bennett and ended up staying for 15 years. And it's about the hard-won lessons of tolerance and patience and generosity. It's actually really more about Alan Bennett than it is about this woman who prefers to be referred to as Miss Shepherd. It's about him and him getting over himself. And there are two versions of him. There's the actual writer version of him talking to the person who leaves the apartment and goes and does things. So it's kind of navel-gazing.
Is it confusing?
No. It's quite literal. It's quite obvious.
I see. So do we learn life lessons from the homeless person?
We do.
Mm-hmm. Looking at Tim. Tim, you didn't see this.
Didn't see it. I'm sorry.
I did not. And nothing you're describing makes me want to kind of see. I like Maggie Smith, obviously, but it feels like one of those movies that comes out this time of year that feels more like an obligation to learn life lessons in case we hadn't learned any recently.
She's adorably cantankerous. So this is the same director and same writer behind The History Boys, Nicholas Heitner, and Alan Bennett wrote that. So if you like The History Boys, you get little appearances from Francis Delatour and Richard Griffiths and Dominic Cooper and people who are in that movie. I understand that Alan Bennett is a quote-unquote national treasure. This is the quote, the comments we're getting on our What the Flick review of this. Alan Bennett is a national treasure, so I'm inclined to give this a pass. You know, this is okay with me.
In England.
Right. Not here.
Not here.
Right.
Okay.
But they actually shot it outside his actual house.
Oh.
Right.
Was he in it when they shot it?
Serving tea. No.
Being a national treasure.
Right,
here.
Right.
treasure.
This is a Bring Your Grandma movie.
Okay. Well, here's one that's not maybe a Bring Your Grandma movie. Krampus.
We have to keep looking. We have to pair up and take turns.
Yes. Can't go back out there. You see this? It's damn near frostbite in under 4 minutes.
Thank you.
Besides of being sub-zero out there, someone's tearing through your fancy-ass neighborhood, picking everybody off. It's the truth.
Oh, my gosh. Tim, is this the Christmas movie we've all been waiting for?
Well, you're getting it regardless. It doesn't matter. I will say that I don't think this movie is necessarily good, but especially in comparison to this time of year where we get a lot of, you know, Oscar, you know, worthy sort of films, there is something that's just kind of gut-level fun about it. This is very much in the vein of, like, a Gremlins or an Arachnophobia, those sort of fun, scary horror movies. It's only rated PG-13, so it's not super gory. And it's about essentially the old myth of Krampus, sort of the anti-Santa Claus, who's like this evil figure. He visits families that have lost their Christmas spirit. A family, husband and wife, Adam Scott and Toni Collette, have their in-laws in. They're all miserable. Krampus comes to visit. Terrible things happen. I will say...
That sounds like a fantasy.
Yeah. Yes. Nobody. This type of movie that, you know, for a low budget, it actually, I think, kind of has some fun shocks and scares. Adam Scott's really fun. Toni Collette's really fun in it. It's not good enough to recommend, but I will say that if people are kind of craving something that's not highfalutin or about life lessons, Krampus is kind of guilty pleasure fun. And there actually is a little bit of emotion, surprisingly enough, in the movie in terms of what's the like the real spirit of Christmas and appreciating what you have in your life. Again, it's no great shakes, but you could do a lot worse this weekend.
All right. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Christy Lemire, film critic and co-host of What the Flick. It's on YouTube, so check it out. And Tim Grierson is senior U.S. critic for Screen International and vice president of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association. Well, it has been a long, long week, Warren Olney.
It has indeed. We usually try to do something a little bit lighter on Friday, but that has not been possible today, given what's going on in Santa Barbara and all the new revelations about San Bernardino, and the revelations about what's happened there and the connections particularly to ISIS, even though they may be very indirect and only by inspiration rather than direction, still very disturbing. And, of course, the massive amount of material that those folks were able to collect. Where did they get the money to do it? How were they able to put that together? And, of course, what it's done, too, is raise once again the argument over gun control. Should we have more of it? We're hearing the same arguments that we have heard so many times in the past. And we'll try to at least get some guests on our program who might want to move beyond that and make suggestions as to, you know, what we could really do that might make a difference.
Okay, continuing the conversation on gun control at 1 o'clock. Warren Olney, thank you very much.
All right.
And coming up on this program, it's Christmas, so we must be at war. How did the war on Christmas begin anyway? We'll talk about that next on Press Play.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. For those of you who celebrate Christmas, do you even say that word anymore? Or are you wishing your friends happy holidays? Are your kids getting ready to go on winter break? Well, maybe you are an unwitting casualty in the war on Christmas.
When you start to say you can't say Merry Christmas, and you can't have the creche, and you can't have Christmas carols by choirs, school choirs. It's part of our culture.
Well, and that's the double standard that's applied, and that's what I'm not going to sit down and accept, and I don't think the majority of Americans will, because that is that war on Christmas is the tip of the spear that it really translates into a war on religious freedom, and that's a much bigger problem that we will be facing if we just were to sit back and allow the angry atheists who are armed with an attorney to tell us that we cannot say things like Merry Christmas.
All right, Sarah Palin and Bill O'Reilly on Fox's O'Reilly Factor a couple of years ago. She will be in town tonight to talk about the war on Christmas, and Palin will be speaking at the holiday party of a conservative Hollywood group called Friends of Abe. Well, here to talk about the war on Christmas and the provenance of it is Emma Green, managing editor of The Atlantic, where she also writes about religion and culture. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, how did this whole war on Christmas thing begin in the first place?
So there's a significant degree of the war on Christmas that is just basically a media creation. The Bill O'Reilly Show and The O'Reilly Factor and Fox News were pretty big drivers of this when it was first starting to come up. This was in the early 2000s, roughly around 2004. Since then, it's become a full-on cultural tradition. Every single year, there are these debates back and forth that take the same form. Politicians like Sarah Palin saying that these little tiny aggressions against Christmas represent a broader cultural phenomenon. But in recent years, it's waned a little bit, and it will be interesting to see what this Christmas season brings.
Well, it's already brought this from this war on Christmas has reached Starbucks. And here's a clip from a viral YouTube video.
You know, I think in the age of political correctness, we become so open-minded, our brains have literally fallen out of our head. Do you realize that Starbucks wanted to take Christ and Christmas off of their brand new cups? That's why they're just plain red. In fact, do you realize that Starbucks isn't allowed to say Merry Christmas to customers? Well, I decided, instead of simply boycotting, well, why don't we just start a movement? So when I went in and I asked for my coffee, they asked for my name, and I told them my name is Merry Christmas. So guess what, Starbucks? I tricked you into putting Merry Christmas on your cup.
Okay, I guess he had the last word on that. So how did Starbucks get caught up in this whole thing?
You know, the clip that you played is a little bit of a internet phenomenon that was happening last month. And basically what happened was this pastor who has his own website and describes himself as a motivational speaker and someone who really connects with millennials posted this Facebook video, and it got millions and millions and millions of views. But the problem is that it's sometimes difficult to parse out whether those millions of views are people who agree with him, who agree that Starbucks is basically trying to create a war on Christmas by only having red cups rather than cups that show, for example, the nativity scene, and people who really think that what he's talking about is ridiculous. A lot of the virality of this was people sort of wondering whether it really matters that Starbucks has red cups, especially considering that the company has other coffee brands that are Christmas blends and other kinds of Christmas cheer.
Well, is anyone taking this seriously, or is it just a game on the right and the left?
I think on the one hand, there certainly is an element of performance about it. People who are trying to create controversy, such as the guy who was featured in that video about the Starbucks Christmas cups, I think there's a certain amount of trying to drum up rage and be provocative. And then on the other side, I do think people on the left certainly have an eye-rolling effect when they're thinking about things like war on Christmas coming up over and over again on Fox News. But there are some deeper issues that this alludes to. So on the one hand, we heard Sarah Palin talking about issues like religious liberty, and this is something that has come up time and again, especially over the past year in American politics, a fear, especially among conservative evangelical Christians, that their culture is in retreat, and wondering what these little tiny cultural signifiers mean for their legal freedoms and for their abilities to practice their faith in public.
Right, and there are these ongoing fights every holiday season or Christmas season about nativity scenes. Here in Santa Monica, there was a lit nativity scene. I think it was a life-size nativity scene in the Palisades Park for a long time, for decades, but that was removed. So, you know, these things do play out in the real world.
Absolutely. And I think the nativity scenes are a really interesting case study for this. There have been court battles over nativity scenes for more than four decades. And in the 80s, the Supreme Court took this up in a pair of cases that were kind of confusing, actually. But basically what the courts ruled were, on the one hand, you can have a nativity scene at times and it doesn't necessarily violate the Establishment Clause. But also, if it's on public grounds, it can't have some of this, you know, sort of overtly, expressly religious language to it. I think in the case of the Santa Monica crash, there was an interesting cultural factor at play, too, which was some people who were involved with the city reported that not many groups really were interested in putting up displays at Christmas time anyways. So it was kind of this one lone group that really wanted to have their nativity scene, and everyone else was a little bit ambivalent or apathetic about it. So it's interesting. There are a lot of cultural factors that play into these legal battles.
Right. And is it just it's just a battle over Christianity, or are there other, you know, are the religions getting involved when it comes to symbols and how we discuss them in public? It seems to be mainly Christians and Christianity that's the topic.
I think that's true, and certainly with war on Christmas rhetoric, that is not only Christians, but Protestant Christians in particular, who tend to talk about this. But, you know, there are lots of other religious faiths that do have these interesting legal conflicts over the way that they practice their faith in public. Menorahs, for example, have become a feature of the December landscape, and certainly that will be true when Hanukkah starts this Sunday. And that actually has an interesting legal history as well. In one of these same cases where the Supreme Court ruled that a crush that had a religious message that actually had like a verse from the Bible, that wasn't allowed, but the menorah was allowed on public property. So there's sort of an interesting back and forth in tension here, where we think about this a lot when it comes to nativity scenes, but the menorahs just seem pretty much like a regular part of December.
So there's no war on Hanukkah yet?
I don't know. I mean, you know, that's a think piece waiting to be written, I think, on the internet. But I don't think many people have claimed that there's a war on Hanukkah. No.
Well, I mean, conversely, have people claimed that this, you know, all this talk about there being a war on Christmas is kind of dog whistling and a bit anti-Semitic?
interesting. I don't know if I would call it anti-Semitic necessarily. I do think there is a degree of dog whistling from it, which is the war on Christmas itself is probably pretty much manufactured rage and something that keeps the ratings going and the airtime filled on Fox News during December. But I think the issues that it symbolizes and alludes to are really deep, meaningful, substantive conflicts in American culture. And this is particularly with the sort of decline or retreat of conservative evangelical Protestantism, Supreme Court rulings that have ruled against sort of cultural mores that used to be very much in line with Protestant Christianity that no longer are the case, such as the gay marriage ruling. I think there's a real fear and a sense of uncertainty in certain religious communities about what their public practice of faith is going to look like. And the war on Christmas is sort of a symbolic arena for those questions to be adjudicated.
Emma Green, managing editor at The Atlantic, thank you and happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
Hi, Julie Myers.
Hello.
How's it going?
Good. I want to point out that the only holiday that truly matters is Thanksgiving.
I agree.
Sorry. Uncontroversial. Objectively awesome. Thanksgiving.
And you get to eat a lot.
Mostly that. So at the beginning of the show today, we talked about the fact that the FBI has ruled that the mass shooting in San Bernardino, or they're pursuing it as an act of terrorism. We posted that on Facebook, and we got a lot of people saying, this is all terrorism. Hello, people. Of course it's terrorism. Duh, of course it's terrorism kind of thing. But we also had Michael Newport leave a message on our Facebook page, and he says there is a distinct definition to the word terrorism. That is why any responsible news source has to be careful when applying the word as a description of any act of violence. There's a political portion of it. It has to be ideologically driven. And he says terrorism isn't just simply an act of violence that is terrifying. Words have meanings.
All right. Thanks, Julie Myers. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great afternoon, great weekend. I will see you on Monday.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation. Rick and Suzanne Kane and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane. The Kane Foundation is committed to enriching the cultural and civic life of Los Angeles. For over a decade, the Kane Foundation has made strategic grants to make Los Angeles a better place to live for future generations.